Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Network on Saturday, December 9th, 2017. This is episode 1446. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is powered by Blue Bottle Coffee, today especially. Get fresh, high-quality, delicious coffee delivered right to your door. I think I'm drinking Giant Steps today. Visit bluebottlecoffee.com/techguy for $10 off your first coffee subscription order. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, all that jazz. Phone number is 8888-ASK-LEO, 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada outside that area. No, it's okay. It's okay. You can still call. In fact, we want you to call. I love hearing from people all over the world. Just to use Skype or one of them there thingamabobs to make that call. 888-827, you know what I'm talking about, the voice over the internet doohickeys. 888-827-5536. Let's just check real quickly. Bitcoin's 14,900. Oh, it's a big drop. So it's up. It's doubled since last month. But it's down. It's down over the last couple of days. Are you falling for the Bitcoin mania? Are you falling for that? It reminds me of Holland, February 1637. Huh?
Tulips.
February 1637. So in Holland, you know, they're famous for tulips, right? And in the 17th century, you could go buy tulips in Holland. You could go buy, tulips for planting. I guess, though, what happened was a tulip, get this, in 1637, the Dutch were always very, you know, really our whole concept of stock markets and these financial institutions, insurance, all this comes from Holland in the 17th century. But they created a tulip futures market. A tulip futures market. People were, and this is widely considered the first speculative bubble. People were buying single tulip bulbs for 10 times the yearly wage of the average skilled craftsman. 10 times the yearly wage. Bitcoin's got a way to go. What happened? Well, we don't know. Other flowers, the hyacinth, for instance, also, I believe, a bulb, yes, had high initial prices when introduced, but then fell. But for some reason, tulips went crazy in 1637. A single bulb. At one point, somebody offered 12 acres of land for a single tulip bulb. A speculative bubble. Tulips came from Turkey, I believe. So they were new to Holland. They were introduced in the mid-16th century, first to Vienna. And then the Flemish botanist Carolus Clusinius at the University of Leiden established a horticultural school and planted a collection of tulip bulbs and found that they loved the climate of Holland, the harsh climate. It was unlike any other flower they'd seen. Such an intense color. They became a luxury item. People started bringing tulips in. There were the red tulips, the yellow, the white, the multicolored rosen, the violetten, the rarest of all, the Bizarden, yellow or white streaks on a red or purple background. I've never seen that. Maybe they were just too expensive for the tulip farms I grew up with. So it's considered, widely considered, the first speculative bubble, where the value of a tulip bulb so far exceeded its potential, mainly because people thought they could resell the bulb, not because they wanted that one tulip for 10 times a yearly wage, but they thought, well, some other sucker, investor's going to come along. Well, that's what's happening right now with not just Bitcoin, but all of these cryptocurrencies. You know what? I'm sure you've seen these headlines, and I'm wondering what people know about this. What it is? It's what they call it sometimes, a cryptocurrency, because it uses sophisticated mathematical techniques taken from cryptography to generate, to mine, in effect, the coins. There's no pickaxe. It's not deep underground. You mine the coin with a computer that solves tough mathematical problems. And when the problem is solved, a Bitcoin or a fraction of a Bitcoin drops out. It was created, I don't know, about 10 years ago with a guy named Satoshi, or a guy or guys. We don't know. He or she has disappeared. It's widely agreed it was a pseudonym anyway. Satoshi Nakamoto wrote the paper. And by the way, we know Satoshi's disappeared because you can only, Bitcoin is anonymous. It's kind of like cash is anonymous, except that you have an account with a long cryptographic digit, a number that represents your account. You can give out that number for people to donate, and you can use your private key. It's a public key, private key kind of thing. You can use your private key to unlock the account and get the coin out, send it to other people, or there is a market for exchanging them into U.S. dollars or other currency. Nakamoto created this whole construct and kept a few to himself, billions, it turns out now, billions of dollars worth of Bitcoin, and he hasn't touched them or moved them or done anything with them in years. So people don't know what to think. What is Bitcoin good for? Not much. Much like a tulip bulb, there are places you can buy Bitcoin, although they're getting fewer and fewer because of the volatility and the value of Bitcoin. Very famously, in the early days of Bitcoin, one of its early proponents bought a pizza. Two pizzas, sorry, got to get it right, for 10,000 Bitcoin. That's 100 million or more. What is it? It's a lot of money. That wasn't that long ago. That was 2010, the poor guy. 10,000 Bitcoins to buy two pizzas. I'd have to get my calculator out now to figure out what that's worth. It's roughly $100 million. And so you imagine this guy's thinking, wow, I wish I'd kept those Bitcoin. But again, they have really no value. Steam, which is the gaming company, you can buy video games from, was accepting Bitcoin. They stopped because they said, well, it's too volatile and the cost of a transaction has gone up so high. It used to be 0.2 cents. Now it's $20 per transaction, the fee. And that's all built into the Bitcoin algorithm, by the way, to buy it. It's slow. It sometimes takes 24 hours to close a transaction just because of the volume. Even Coinbase, which is one of the places you can go and exchange your Bitcoin for dollars, is saying it might take a while if you want to sell your Bitcoin. We've got a lot of people cashing in. But it's all speculative. There's actually a market for virtual kitties. This is an Ethereum, another cryptocurrency, very similar. People have spent over $1 million buying these cats. They have no, they're even less valuable than a tulip bulb. But the speculation is, I buy this cat, this virtual kitty, and I'm going to sell it to some other investor down the road and make money. See, it's all about, it all depends on this market and kind of the increase in value. And I think Bitcoin's very similar. People will say, well, a dollar is what we call a fiat currency. It's all faith. Yeah. But it's kind of backed by the, as they say, full faith and credit of the United States government. Bitcoin not backed by anybody. Here's the funny part. I know many people who have Bitcoins, can't get them. I have myself 7.8 Bitcoins, more than $100,000 of Bitcoins locked in a wallet somewhere. I have a friend who has 50, more than $1 million, just hanging around. Do you have any Bitcoin? 1-888-ASK-LEO, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. No charge, no Bitcoin cost for this. Bitcoin's got, I'm 10% done. Bitcoin's got valuable, they've created a fraction of a Bitcoin called a Satoshi. I don't know, what is a Satoshi worth?
Remember Dogecoin?
Yeah, what happened to Dogecoin?
Well, my 20,000 Dogecoin is worth about $50.
Oh, that's good. John has 20,000 Dogecoin. Padre had a Dogecoin miner, yeah.
So his Dogecoin is worth like one Bitcoin.
Not bad. I'd take it.
And if you go to the place where they, I don't know if it's Coinbase, or but if you, it shows all the values of the coins.
Of all the different kinds of coins?
Well,
Coinbase has some charts here. Let's see. Here's the current value of Bitcoin, which is going down, but will it go up? Might go up. My son says, I think I'm going to dabble in Bitcoin. Let's look at the value over the entire, since 2013, when it started at $13 or something. Wow. Whoa. Wow. It's, you know what? That's the hockey stick right there. Here's Ethereum. Here's Litecoin. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888-ASK. Leo, I have to ask Kim, did you buy any Bitcoin in the crazy Bitcoin bubble?
No, I was going to – no, I didn't. Definitely didn't buy it at the height here, but I
– Maybe you prefer to buy a CryptoKitty.
When I heard this story this week, I'm like, oh, Leo's having a really good week. He just made a lot of money.
Well,
by
I didn't.
Doing nothing.
I don't know if I did. So I didn't know. So you can buy these crypto kitties for as little as $12, although the most expensive one's $112,000.
Oh.
The idea being, I guess if you buy it and take care of it, somebody will come along. It's all speculative, right? Same thing with Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So, maybe it'll be worth more than $20,000 someday.
But isn't that the same as stocks? That's all
speculative.
Well,
there's a difference. There's a difference. A stock is theory, in theory anyway, tied to the value and the profitability of a corporation. This is tied to nothing. It's tied to what people will pay. It's kind of the ultimate test of currency, right? A piece of paper in your pocket with George Washington's picture on it isn't necessarily worth. I mean, what is that worth? It's a piece of paper. But because we all agree
that it's a dollar.
It's a dollar.
Yeah.
And it'll get a dollar's worth of goods. But that the value of a dollar changes.
All the time.
And so Bitcoin is a little more speculative only because it's not backed by a government.
Right.
But in every other respect, it's a fiat currency, a currency that exists in value only because people believe it exists in value. It's just not propped up by anybody.
Well, so, the Winkelvosses are doing pretty well.
They did well. So this is an interesting story. The Winklevoss twins, you may remember from the movie The Social Network,
like
they were
Facebook.
Two Harvard seniors who commissioned a young freshman named Mark Zuckerberg to write a social network for them. Yeah. Mark kind of took all their ideas, disappeared. He ghosted. They didn't have the word ghosting until later.
He hid in his room and wrote this.
He ghosted on him, wrote Facebook. And then they came after him later, sued him, and you know, we never knew how much he made. They made from Mark, but the story that I've just read that the settlement was $11 million. They invested it in Bitcoin. They are now Bitcoin billionaires.
Yep.
So I had a wallet. I created a wallet in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Back when Bitcoin. Let me see what Bitcoin was worth in 2013. You know,
a couple of bucks.
Yeah. And I, at the time, I said, people can donate to the wallet if they want. And they did. And my friend Russell, who's our IT genius here, looked on Friday and said, you know, you have 7.8 Bitcoins in that wallet. I said, what? Because you can see what the wallet's worth. All of this is public. You can't see who the wallet belongs to. It's only a cryptographic signature. But if you know what the donation address is, and Russell did, you can look it up and say, oh, yeah, you could see the transactions, 7.8. So that's like $149,000.
That's not bad, especially doubling in a week.
Well, here's the problem.
You can't get in.
Well, you store it in a digital wallet, right?
Right.
And we've heard many, many stories of Bitcoin wallets being stolen, being hacked. And if you lose your Bitcoin, you've lost it. There's no buddy to go to and say, right, I want my Bitcoin back. So I was always very nervous about it. But I did back it up, and that's the good news. And so I found, I started looking. I said, I wonder where my money is. And I found a wallet I created in 2013 and one in 2014. I think they're probably the same wallets. So now what you have to do, this is weird. Okay, what you have to do now is you download the blockchain, which is a kind of like an accounting book, a registry of all Bitcoin transactions ever. Now, as one might imagine, that has grown fairly large, is over 150 gigabytes of data. So I let the computer over the last couple of days just download that blockchain.
Oh, wow.
So now I have the blockchain on my computer, and then I've put my wallet in, and it's now churning through the wallet. And what it's doing is it's about 17% done. Took
over
half an hour.
Days?
No,
oh.
No, I got the whole blockchain.
Oh, okay.
But when I put the wallet in, it said, oh, well, let me look and see all the transactions associated with that cryptographic signature.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's doing right now. And if with all in any luck, it will go in about an hour or two.
By the end of the show.
I hope by the end of the show it'll go cha-ching and it'll say you have 7.8 Bitcoin. Then there's one more step, because I'm pretty sure, being the paranoid, careful, security conscious person that I am, that I encrypted it. So I'll need my password to unencrypt it.
And do you know what that is?
No, I didn't record. Well, I didn't record it, but that means usually if I generate it with LastPass, which is going to generate a very good, strong password, it'll be recorded. It's not in my LastPass, which means I probably used one of my, I'm thinking I used my PGP passphrase. I'm hoping if it's that, then I'll be able to get into it. And then I have a tough decision, and I wonder what our audience thinks. 7.81 Bitcoin is worth about $149,000 right now. I could go cash it in.
Mm-hmm.
Pay tax on it, by the way. That's,
okay.
Yeah. Or just let it sit.
Let it ride.
It's very much like that.
Yeah. It's a total gamble.
Do you let it ride? Do you cash it in? My wife says, cash in half of it, or cash in one or two Bitcoin just to get a little something.
I'm very conservative, so I probably would cash in some and let some ride.
There's a real chance that, it could go either way. If you had said 5 years ago, oh, Bitcoin's ever going to go, it's look how high it is, it's $800, I would have probably said, it's probably going to crash, I should sell it. And that would have been a mistake.
Right.
Or buy a pizza with it. That would have been a mistake.
That was a huge mistake.
Right.
That guy feels so stupid today.
There's nothing to keep this Bitcoin from reaching $1 million of Bitcoin.
No.
But there's also nothing to keep it from reaching $0 of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
It's going down a little bit now because people are saying...
It got up to what, 17,000?
20.
Oh, 20. Oh, wow.
So people are saying now, maybe I should cash in a little bit. But I think it'll probably go back up because it's like the... But remember, with the Dutch tulip bulbs... The bubble burst, and then tulip bulbs are back to a dime.
Yep.
Hmm.
I'm ready for the housing market to burst.
What should I do? What do you think?
I think my stuff is just safer under my mattress.
I'm just going to leave it in. I mean, this is free money. I never bought any Bitcoin.
Right. You didn't invest a ton into it, so may as well just have fun with it.
I'm going to let it ride. I'm playing. Well, what you're supposed to do is take some money out and say, now I'm playing with the house money.
Yeah.
But I never put any money in. The basis is zero. All right. Well, I've used up enough time that I'm not going to get to a call in this segment. But I think Bitcoin is isn't it fascinating?
It is. I heard the story this week and I said, I hope that we get a chance to talk about this
because
I knew you had some Bitcoin. I wasn't exactly sure, but I've heard you talk about
it. Well, my friend Steve Gibson was going to do a segment on Bitcoin. On our show, we have a show called Security Now, and this is, I think, 2013. And he set up what's called a Bitcoin miner. This is right now. If you wanted to be a Bitcoin miner, you'd have to have free electricity. It uses so much power that you couldn't make money on it. But at that time, he just set up a computer overnight. It generated 50 bitcoins. He has no idea where the wallet is. He has no idea.
So
he's
sad.
Got he's got 55. That's $1 million.
Oh.
He doesn't know.
Poor Steve.
Imagine having $1 million somewhere in your house, but you don't know where
right.
it is. You would look
You're
for it.
You're looking through every shoebox and every crevice.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Scott Wilkinson coming up. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time for Mr. Scott. Speaking of vision, Scott Wilkinson, our home theater expert, editor at avsforum.com. We're continuing the Bitcoin watch now. 27% of the wallet has been scanned. You know, I realize this might be the equivalent of Geraldo's Al Capone's
vault. Yes, the
vault.
Al Capone vault. Yeah, right.
Had I been more savvy, more media savvy, I made played this up.
That's right. Pointed a camera at the progress bar.
Well, I can do. We can watch the progress bar. Because
what fun would that be?
It could be. I could be 100,000-aire, or I could be. It could be nothing. Nothing Bobuffin. Nothing McMuffin
yeah.
here.
Yeah.
And it all depends on the Bitcoin gods.
Indeed.
Yeah. So just to recap, and I guess I'm hoping it'll be done by the show. I think it will be. I have downloaded the Bitcoin blockchain, which is the transactions, all the transactions. And of course, when you do that and I'm using the basic Bitcoin core software, it's the most vanilla. When you do that, it creates its own empty wallet. And I replaced the empty wallet with a wallet that I had backed up from the year 2013. You don't need anything but that crypto key. That's what's stored in the wallet. It's a small file because the crypto key identifies you. What it's doing now is scanning through the register, the blockchain of all transactions, all Bitcoin transactions, to find those that belong to me. And at the end, it will come up, cha-ching. I don't think it'll actually make that sound.
Wouldn't it be cool if it did?
It would be cool. With an amount of Bitcoin, which could be anything from zero to what I believe is all of mine, which is 7.8. And then the next step is to see if we can claim it. But we'll save that for another day. So let's talk, because people are spending their hard-earned actual dollars.
Actual real money.
on gifts. And one of the things people are really interested in these days is sound bars. The easiest way to give your home theater system a boost.
That's right. Many people listen to the sound that their TV makes, right? The audio part. They might have bought a great TV, and they're listening to the speakers that are inside the TV, which sound like crap.
Yeah.
They really do, because the TVs are getting thinner and thinner and thinner.
So I've seen TVs that don't have any speakers at all now.
Those are called monitors, typically, but that is true. There are a few that do, but that don't have any speakers at all. But most of them do. But they're so tiny that they can't help but sound really bad. And so, you know, me as a geek, I would love to see somebody install a whole surround system with an AVR and speakers all over the place. But in some cases, that's simply not practical. And in other cases, your spouse might object. I don't want all those speakers around here. But you want better sound. So what do you do? Well, my recommendation is getting a sound bar, which is basically a speaker, which is long and thin, and you place it under the TV, in front of the TV, and hopefully under it. And it's got a number of speaker drivers in it, and they go anywhere from 2-channel, basic stereo, all the way up to Atmos, you know, with surround sound and sound coming from overhead. And you might say, how the heck do they do that? Well, the answer is with clever digital signal processing, or DSP. That's one part of the equation. Another part of the equation is where they place the actual drivers inside the cabinet. They might be firing off to the sides as well as straight ahead, or even upwards. And the sound reflects off the ceiling and gives you this immersive Atmos-like effect. So in any case, it's going to sound better than the speakers in your TV. So it's no wonder that it's a popular gift item, because it's probably more or less the least expensive way you can significantly improve the sound of your TV and not have to worry about speakers all around the room.
But when you say least expensive, there's quite a range.
There is. That's
prices.
True.
It could be $100. It could be thousands of dollars, right?
It could be. That's right. And in fact, on AVS Forum, we have been doing a series of best of product categories. And in the soundbar category, based upon our own reviews, and in the soundbar category, we have five, I believe, starting at the least expensive with something from Polk. You know the company Polk?
Which is a good company, although
very good company.
They probably
they
have been bought by people, right? I mean, that's one of the problems. You can't trust a brand name anymore because
It's true. There are parent companies and mergers and so on. So I honestly don't know what the
I'll look it up.
The corporate thing.
I'm thinking maybe Logitech because they bought Cambridge Soundworks and I might have bought Polk, but maybe it's a Denon and Marantz company, which means
it may be
a Samsung now.
Or no, Denon and Marantz.
No, Samsung bought Denon and Marantz, I thought.
No. Samsung bought Harman.
Oh, okay.
Sound United bought Denon and Marantz.
Good luck figuring out who owns whom.
Yeah, exactly. I just go by the brand names for the most part. So the Polk Magnify Mini is a $250 soundbar. Comes with a wireless subwoofer. And by the way, a lot of soundbars come with a wireless subwoofer, and I do recommend that you get one with a subwoofer, which you can place almost anywhere in the room, and it connects to the soundbar wirelessly. It gives you better bass. There's no two ways about it. It just, even a soundbar, which has better speakers and a larger volume inside the cabinet to make a better sound, still can't give you that deep, low bass.
Oh, my goodness. You know who owns Polk Audio?
No.
Daryl Issa.
Really? the congressman?
The congressman, DEI Holdings, which was founded by Issa and his wife, Kathy.
Yeah.
Way back before he was a member of Congress.
Wow. Yeah. I didn't know.
He owns Polk Audio.
Oh, well, there you go.
Definitive Technology and Boom Movement.
I don't know. If,
yeah, I think he's still. Wait a minute.
he might have sold that. I don't know.
March 2017, the Sound United Audio Division was acquired by D&M Group, of course, Denon.
Yep.
And Marantz and Boston Acoustics. I don't know who owns them. It's almost impossible.
Anyway, if you want the least expensive soundbar,
Denon and Marantz owns Polk Audio.
Okay, there you go. Okay, so Polk is part of Sound United then.
Yeah.
Or Daryl Issa or whatever.
Yeah.
In any event, if you want to spend the least amount of money and get something pretty good, I recommend Vizio. They make soundbars of different sizes, and you want a size that'll fit under your TV. You know, so if you have a big TV, you want a bigger one than if you have a smaller TV. But Vizio makes everything from 2.0, just the soundbar itself, to 2.1, the soundbar plus a subwoofer, to 5.1, which they actually sell you little satellite speakers that you can put back behind you and get a real surround sound experience. That somewhat defeats the purpose, and there are other soundbars that give you the illusion of surround sound, that is sound to the sides or behind you and even above, which again takes that DSP sort of approach. Yamaha is very famous for that. Their Yamaha YAS-207 for $300 does a good job of that. Samsung has got a couple of really nice soundbars that I want to mention real quick. The HW MS650, $450. It's on the expensive side. And at the top of the list, we have the Samsung HW MS750 with a wireless subwoofer, $1,200. And the Sony HTST5000, $1,500. But that gives you 5.1.2 Atmos surround from a single soundbar. It's very impressive. So, you know, it depends on how much you have to spend, but soundbars can be a great gift this holiday season and really improve the quality of your sound.
Scott Wilkinson, hey, thank you. That's great. Home theater geek. You'll find him at avsforum.com and each week here on the show. Your calls coming up. Mm-hmm. 41% on the Bitcoin wallet.
Oh, you'll be well done before the end of the show.
I'm now actually starting to get nervous. Imagine, I mean, I'm looking at a screen which could deliver into my pocket $100,000+.
Yeah.
I had no idea Daryl Issa Is it Issa or Issa?
I've heard it pronounced Issa.
Who is the most reactionary member of Congress? Well, that's actually a tough. That's a tough.
That's a tough one.
That's a tough, row to pick one. But he's pretty reactionary.
Yeah, he is.
Owns Polk Audio and a bunch of other stuff. Sound United owns D&M.
I thought Sound United also, well, if they don't own, they at least represent Polk and Definitive Technology. I'm remembering.
Yeah, they do. And that means I'm confused. Issa was the first CEO. They bought Definitive Technology in 2004. They bought Polk Audio in 2006. They became DEI Holdings. They combined Polk, Definitive Technology, and the Boom Movement brands into one called Sound United. So Sound United is them.
Yep.
And the Sound United Audio Division in this March acquired D&M, Denon, Marantz, and Boston Acoustics.
And Boston Acoustics, that's right. Now I'm remembering.
That is wild. I mean, yeah, really, that's wild.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty amazing. But Polk's, this Magnify Mini soundbar, pretty amazing. $250.
That's your recommendation?
For the low end, yeah.
Yeah.
And if you need to go lower than that, go to Vizio.
Yeah. He's because of this, the richest member of Congress. Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Okay. You have 2 minutes if you want it.
Can you
stick around for the top?
Sure.
I feel like time is going by faster for some
reason.
Yeah,
well, that's
life, huh?
That's life. That's part of getting older. as we get older, time seems to go faster. And I study this a lot.
It does.
There's a number of reasons why that may be. One is you have more memory. As you
Bitcoin.
Get, it's a BRA. Yeah, right.
It's Bitcoin. Hey, how was Tuba Christmas?
Tuba Christmas was awesome. It was great. We had a great audience. We had the largest number of tuba players. We had about 127 tubas on stage.
Wow.
And my wife and I had written a new arrangement for Tuba Hanukkah that went very well. Santa Claus showed up, of course, and
nice.
I did a little interview with him. Go ahead.
And you're okay with the fires? I've neglected.
Yes,
to
we're
ask.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Yes, they're all around us, but holy they're not cow. Anywhere really close, so we didn't have to worry about it. In fact, some of my Tuba Christmas buddies live up in Sunland, and at least one of them had their car packed up and ready to go.
Wow.
They didn't have to leave, fortunately, but they were kind of at the edge of the evacuation zone. But oh my goodness, the air quality is so awful.
We've been there.
Man, all right, you have not.
Can you stick around for the top of the hour?
Sure, yeah, happy
all right.
to.
Thank you, Scott. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. The Bitcoin wallet watch continues. Christmas might come early to the tech guy, and again, I might get coal. 46% scanned. It could go either way. 8888 ask Leah, let's get to the phones. I've been remiss, all caught up in Bitcoin mania. You see what speculative bubbles can do, and not paying attention to the most important part of the show. You, Lance in San Diego's first up. Hi, Lance.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah, that Bitcoin thing is quite interesting. I kind of hearken it back to the dot-com bubble when I was in the airport in San Francisco, and the shoeshine guy told me to invest in hobbies.com.
Oh, that would have been a mistake. Or pets.com. On the other hand, if you'd bought Amazon stock back then, you might be doing all right. So as with all speculation, it's all about timing and luck and I guess some common sense. I don't know.
Right.
Yep.
Well, listen, had a Dell XPS for 10 years, loved the heck out of it, had Windows 7 Enterprise on it with all the Microsoft stuff, had Office 2010, and it got all loaded up, and it's at the end of its life, so for a Christmas present, I bought myself the new Dell XPS 15 with the 4K super HD screen.
Oh, I'm jealous. Just love it. That, isn't it nice? Yeah. I have been an XPS 13 lover for some time, that, especially since they went to the practically bezel-less screen, and they announced the 15 this year. And wow, I think you have a nice system.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. And you still there?
Yep.
Okay. So I want to transfer my – I got Microsoft – I got the new Microsoft Office 2016 on it. And I want to start transferring the files that I want from my old one that's slowly dying to the new XPS. And I want to be able to control what I want to bring over and what I don't, including all my old emails from Outlook. So what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, I mean, Microsoft comes with a transfer wizard that will let you move that stuff, but it doesn't give you much granularity. So, and in general, especially with Windows, I like to start fresh, which you have, right? Because you have a clean, fresh new PC. And then you can pick and choose what you want. I think that's a better way to go. The real problem with doing it that way is you'll have to reinstall applications. But I'm always nervous about using the transfer programs because they tend to transfer more junk than you want. They bring other stuff over. So if you have... Do you have the original disks for the software you want to install? Or nowadays, it's less of an issue because all you really need is the serial number for the software you want to install.
By and large, I do.
It's almost always best to reinstall anyway.
So okay. I mean, I reinstalled the new Office 2016, and
there
I have
go.
The resident.
There you go. That's the big
I have
one.
The resident. Right, that's the big one.
Yeah.
And I have the resident Office 2010 still on my old one, but I want to transfer particularly my my Outlook.
So Outlook is easy. Outlook is easy. Do you want to install, do you want to copy the entire Outlook setup or just some folders?
The entire one.
All right, easy enough. Outlook stores all of its stuff in a folder or file, I should say, called outlook.pst. It's actually one of the one of the things that makes Outlook a little fragile. Is everything, your calendar, your address book, and all your mail are all stored in one big blob. But it's very convenient. In fact, it's for this particular purpose, it's the most convenient. It's easy to move that blob over. You can, if you wish, archive and copy, and then import the archive. That's probably the Microsoft-approved way. But frankly, I've done it, and maybe I shouldn't recommend this. I've just moved the PST file over. You need to find it. And then move it over into the onto the new computer in the same spot.
So when you do that, is it a drop and drag with a USB or what is it?
But that's not Microsoft's approved way of doing it. So let me tell you the right way. It is you can drag and drop it, but what Microsoft says is you should probably export and then import. And I think the advantage of doing that is it will rebuild the index and the database. So that Outlook, as you probably noticed, that Outlook.pst file can get massive.
Huge.
Huge. And this will help compress it. Okay. So that is a very valuable way to do it. So if you go into Outlook on the file tab, you'll see there's under advanced an export command. And a wizard. And you can check things you want to export. You'll export it to a PST file, but you'll do it in such a way that you're really recreating the file in the index. And I think that that's a good, healthy thing to do. You still have the original. You haven't touched it. And you can walk through this process. You will then get a PST file that you'll copy onto a USB disk or something and copy over to the next one. But it's pretty straightforward. You're going to use the export command, in other words.
The export command in Outlook?
In Outlook. File, advanced, export.
Okay.
You can do it folder. You can do it folder by folder if you want, but since you want the whole thing, just do the whole dang thing.
Okay.
And then you'll import it. Then you'll move it to you'll copy the file over, but you're not going to copy on top of the new Outlook.pst on your new computer. You're going to just import it into Outlook.
Okay. I'm a little confused there. So you take the PST... from the import export,
it'll create a PST which we should probably call, old Outlook data, .pst.
Right.
Copy that one file onto a USB key. Plug that USB key into the new Dell XPS 2015. And then open Outlook on the new computer. And same place as you found, you know, file advanced, you'll find import. And you say import, and you point it at the file. You could really import it from the USB key if you want. It might be a little faster if you copy it to the hard drive first. But you can just import it right from the key. And that will then copy everything.
Gotcha.
And it'll do it, I think, in a help more. It'll be a more healthful way. In fact, it's an interesting thing to look at the original Outlook.pst on your old XPS and then look at the resulting Outlook.pst. It'll probably be half the size or less.
Right. And that Outlook 2016, I mean, it's beautiful,
isn't it?
I mean, it's I've sat the computer next to the MacBook Pro, and I got to tell you, this Dell XPS 15, I think it's nicer looking. I think it's better.
You know, Apple is conservative in screen technology. They make great screens, but they don't. You know, for instance, I have an OLED screen on my ThinkPad that Apple's not using, and it's gorgeous. It's the best screen I've ever used. And Dell, with these, they call them infinity displays because the bezel's so small, really are using great panels. They look great. I think it's still an LCD, but it's a very nice LCD screen. I agree with you.
Right.
Yep.
And then with the other files, like my, my PDFs, just drag and drop those into new box.
You know, you have a documents and settings folder and you have a user, you know, account, your user account. You can, if you want, if you've got a big enough external hard drive, just copy that entire thing onto an external hard drive and move it onto the new computer if you want.
Right.
That'll get all your data. And if you want to pick and choose, you can pick and choose. But that'll get all your data. And then reinstall the apps, always the best way to do that. And frankly, that's probably the best way to set up a new computer. More time consuming and painstaking, but you're still getting a fresh setup. You don't want to copy a lot of the useless cruft over.
Right, right. Well, great. Now I can even enjoy the XPS even more.
I tell you what, you got a nice computer. Enjoy.
Okay, Leo.
Take care. Yeah, I love those XPSs. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We're going to come back with more of your calls right after this. But first, Scott Wilkinson.
Woo-hoo.
Woo! Let me move your thing. Oh, my God. Go.
Oh, man. Diabetes, high blood pressure,
Scott,
anxiety.
Let's see where I am. 59%. We're still scanning.
Okay.
59%.
You're going to get there well before the end of the show.
Oh, yeah. But right now is you.
Thank you so much. So glad to be with you all. Thank you for being here. Emily the Strange asked me about if I was looking forward to Star Wars, which I am. I was very disappointed in The Force Awakens. I thought it was, come on, it's just another retelling of the same damn story. Let's see something new. So I'm hoping, one can only hope, that The Last Jedi will be something new, something different, something to spark the imagination, like the original. Don't just tell the original story again. Anyway, I'm seeing it in Dolby Cinema. Emily asked if I was seeing it in IMAX, and the answer is no. I wonder, is it in 3D in IMAX? I'll have to go look and see. I don't remember. If it is, then I'm definitely not seeing it in IMAX. If I did see it in IMAX, I'd go to an IMAX laser theater, not a regular digital theater where they have a bulb. I would go see it in a 70-millimeter film IMAX. Possibly, but Dolby Vision HDR just does it for me. And Atmos Sound, both those things are only available in a Dolby Cinema. And both of them combine to make what I've always said is the best theatrical experience available, period. And so that's where I want to see it. So I got my ticket, a couple months ago they were starting to sell tickets. And so I got a pretty good seat in my favorite row in my local Dolby Cinema, row G. My favorite seat, G13, was already sold, so I'm a few seats over from that, but close enough. Yeah, Beatmaster, good luck with something new in Star Wars 8. Have fun seeing Luke again. Yeah, you know, he could be good. I saw him on, not in Letterman. Shows you how old I am. Colbert, late show with Stephen Colbert last night. And I thought it was hilarious. They couldn't talk about the movie. You know, it's so under wraps, that's so secret that nobody, you know, nobody from the show, they have to go out and promote it, but they can't talk about it. What? They did a pretty funny Star Wars parody after the monologue, which I thought was pretty funny. anyway, so there it is. Emily the Strange, yeah, didn't like Force Awakens, still excited for this one. Too nerdy. Yeah, you and me, Emily. I'm super nerdy. I'm just, that's the way it is. CO Bra says it just got a TCL 55 P605. I thought it was P607. Did they have a 605 as well? Anyway, I do recommend the TCL P series. Absolutely. So good luck with that and congratulations. I'm sure you will enjoy it immensely. Let's see. What else can we talk about? Somebody here mentioned PsyChops, PSChops, PsChops, sent me a link to a trombone flash mob at Lincoln Center led by New York Philharmonic principal Joe Alessi. Oh, I can't wait to see that. That'll be great. I mean, Joe Alessi's a phenomenal trombone player. Principal of LA Phil has got to be. But a flash mob, that was great. I didn't record, Lumpy, I did not record Tuba Christmas videotape it this year, but I did in 2012, and those videos are up at tubachristmasla.com/gallery. So I have photos up there, and I also have videos. And that will also lead you to the YouTube channel, the Tuba Christmas LA YouTube channel, where there are more videos still. So I hope you do enjoy that. We didn't get much smoke in Glendale, RF Guy. Thanks for asking. Somebody here was talking. Oh, user 2364 was asking about Onkyo receivers getting hot. And that has been a problem. Leo, do you have an Onkyo receiver still?
I do.
Yeah. And does it get really hot if it's on for a while?
I don't know. I haven't touched it.
Okay.
Maybe. Yeah.
I think you went to Denon.
I have two. I have an Onkyo and I have a Denon. Now, the Denon is the 4K.
Right.
And and it, you know, I'll tell you what, maybe it does. I actually have stopped closing the cabinet. But there's a lot of stuff in that cabinet. You know, I should probably put a fan on it.
Well, that's generally a good idea for any, particularly something that uses a lot of current, like a Navy receiver or a power amp.
Right.
You don't want to close it up in a closet because then it is going to get too hot. Onkyos had a particular problem. They got so hot that they sometimes fried the HDMI board.
Jeez. Well, okay, so that's interesting you should say that because I thought it was a fuse blown. But all of a sudden, nothing would work on my Onkyo receiver. And I brought it here to Burke. He couldn't find a fuse, but it seems to have started working again.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I don't. And at the time, I thought it wasn't the heat, but rather a rogue Apple TV, which I took out, and everything seems to be working. And it was an out-of-date one anyway. So I don't know. It's conceivable, though, that you could have something with a short in its HDMI that would then short out the HDMI on the receiver, I think.
It's possible. Yeah. It's possible. My recollection is some years ago, quite a few now, the HDMI boards were dying because of excess heat. And Onkyo apparently fixed the problem.
Yeah.
And it hasn't really come up. I haven't seen any sort of complaints about that more lately.
My Onkyo is a few years old, so I should.
Yeah. You should check that out.
I really liked it because it had a lot of nice features. It had excellent DACs.
It was really good.
The Onkyo could read all of my FLAC 24-bit, you know, 92 and
96
higher.
96
kilohertz and higher stuff. So that was nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Onkyo makes good stuff. They just had this problem. I think the modern models have solved the problem. So
it's not an unusual problem in consumer electronics, frankly. Remember
no.
the Xbox Red Ring of Death? So, but yeah. I am pretty much dead on now. Except yeah. now that I know it's Daryl Issa, I'm not sure I want to enrich Daryl Issa. So,
well, there is that. But I'm a Denon guy too. What can yeah, I tell you? I have I a really Denon like in my yeah. in my main theater.
Yeah.
Because they make good stuff. Yep. They make good stuff. Yep. And I didn't know that Daryl Issa thing. I did know that it was Sound United, and I should have remembered on the air that Polk was too. But in any event, that is the way of the world, is it not? Somebody, I forget who it is here, UJ maybe, was asking about my research into the speed at which time passes, or the perceived speed at which time passes. One of the most interesting theories about that is called the Dinui effect, which basically says as we get older, our metabolism slows down. Makes sense. And internally, we think our internal clock is going at the same rate all the time. Actually, it's slowing down. But we perceive it as going at the same rate, which means we perceive the clock on the wall as speeding up, going faster and faster.
You know, it's sped up. What clock? Thank you, Scott.
Time to go. Thanks, Leo.
Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers and the internet and home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, augmented reality, virtual reality, and Bitcoin. 8888, ask Leo, the phone number. 888-827-5536, toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. If you want to call outside that area, call via Skype or some other voice over the internet. That should work and still be free. Our website, techguylabs.com, and that's where everything I say is written down, so you don't have to write down any links or anything. It'll all be linked there. In case you're just tuning in, of course, the world's been going crazy over Bitcoin this week. It got as high as $20,000 of Bitcoin, which really upsets the guy who 7 years ago spent 10,000 Bitcoin for two pizzas. 10,000 Bitcoin. What is 10,000 times 20,000? $200 million. It's $100 million of pizza. He must be feeling bad. There's no point in thinking about it. No point in thinking about it. Bitcoin is just one of many so-called cryptocurrencies. There have been a lot of Bitcoin copycats. Is that fair to say? If you go to coinmarketcap.com, you could see all the different cryptocurrencies ranked by market capitalization. So there is $242 billion worth of Bitcoin out there, although I'm told more than a third is lost, like mine was, in somebody's wallet somewhere, and they can't recover it. There's Ethereum, Bitcoin Cash, IOTA, Ripple, Litecoin, Dash, Bitcoin Gold, Monero, NEM, Cardano, Ethereum Classic, Stellar, Lumens, NEO, EOS, Populous, BitConnect, Lisk, Zcash, Qtum, Stratus. These are all cryptocurrencies. That's just the top 20 out of 100. But for some reason, Bitcoin has captured people's imagination. And what's really going on right now is this massive speculation where people think it's going to go up. It was gone up a lot and it's going to go up more. I better buy some. But would you be, you'd be kind of nuts to buy it. What if you'd bought it at 20,000 and now it's trading down to under 15,000? You'd be a little upset, wouldn't you? The people who make money, it looks much like a pyramid scheme. Who makes the money in a pyramid scheme? The first people, the person who sets it up, who loses money in a pyramid scheme, the last people to get in. I'm not saying it is a pyramid scheme, but it sure looks a lot like it. Anyway, I'm trying to recover a Bitcoin wallet I've had around for a while. It has almost 8 Bitcoin in it. That'd be $160,000 at its peak. I'm scanning the blockchain right now with the old wallet, 75% done. And sometime before the show is over, I will find out if I'm a Bitcoin 100,000-aire or nothing. Phone number 8888, ask Leo. On the line, Paul in San Diego. Hi, Paul. How are you?
I am doing just fine.
You're staying safe from the fires and all that.
Oh, it's north of us.
Yeah, but I know. But
yes, man.
Fortunately, the smoke's blowing the other way for you.
Yeah, a few years ago we had a bug out, but that was, happy to say, it never came near us.
Knock on wood, thank goodness, yeah.
Yeah, I feel for all those people.
Oh, so do I.
Yeah, that's living in this beautiful area. You live in the same, similar...
We're in Northern California. It just happened to us a couple of months ago. It's I know many people who lost their homes. Fortunately, I don't know anybody who lost their lives or pets, but people did. It's scary.
Yeah, I live near Del Mar, and they have over 600 horses there.
Yeah. They've been taking from the North County, they've been taking horses down, saving them, but still many have lost their lives.
Yep.
Well, what can I do for you?
I called, my son made me his IT consultant.
Good choice. Usually goes the other way around, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We ask our kids for help.
And he has a 2013 MacBook.
All right.
And it's got Thunderbolt, and he just bought a new display, a 4K display from Dell, I believe. And his work now says he got to use a Lenovo Carbon X1.
Ah, you know what? That's a nice computer.
Yeah, but it has USB-C, and he'd like to use the same monitor and keyboard between both of them without any cables, except for the display cable.
Yeah.
What would your solution be?
There is a program which I have used and have, you know, it's not, but it uses, so there's two ways to do it. You can do it in hardware or you can do it in software. So depends on how, if he wants to use them both at the same time, like move the mouse from one screen, which is the Mac screen, over to the other screen, which is the Windows screen, he could do that in software with a program called Synergy. And it comes from a company called Symless, SYMLESS.com. Is that what he wants to do? He wants to keep both running and be able to go back and forth?
I never heard that request.
All right. So the other way to do it with hardware is with a single monitor, keyboard, and mouse and switch the laptop that's controlling it. So you're working around in Windows. You press a button on a what's called a KVM switch, keyboard, video, and mouse switch, KVM switch. And then that screen goes bloop, and it's now a Windows screen. Is that what he wants to do?
Yeah, I was looking at those things, but every cable is different.
So first of all, the company I would get, there are good companies and there are bad companies. The company I like is iogear, iogear.com. His 2013 MacBook probably, I don't think it's Thunderbolt. It's Mini DisplayPort is what I think it is. So he's driving a monitor with Mini DisplayPort.
Okay.
Or DisplayPort. So what was the monitor he bought? Was it an Apple monitor?
No, his wife took the Apple monitor. Now he's got, he just bought a new one, a 4K from Dell.
Okay. So probably that's HDMI. Almost certainly that has HDMI in it. It might have DisplayPort in it. If it does, that's very simple. You connect. So the IO gear is a hardware box. It will have USB ports. You know, you can get one that supports four computers. You only need one that supports two computers. So it'll have two keyboard ports, two mouse ports, two video, with a variety of video ports, because it's understood that different monitors have different requirements. HDMI is the pretty much the simplest. So he'll have the laptop go into the Mini DisplayPort on the KVM switch, but the KVM will have one out to the monitor, right? Because there's only one, and it'll be HDMI. That's the standard. So you want HDMI out. That'll come from the KVM switch to the screen, and then you just want to make sure you get a KVM that has a input that works with both the ThinkPad and the MacBook. And so you'll have to look with the MacBook out. I think a 2013 MacBook, it's almost certainly DisplayPort out, Mini DisplayPort out.
Can you use the same keyboard?
You bet. The whole idea is one monitor, one mouse, one keyboard controlling two computers.
Right. And how many cables go?
Well, it's exactly that many cables. So the keyboard is connected to the KVM switch. The mouse is connected to the KVM switch. The monitor is connected to the KVM switch. That's three. And then each computer, you only need one USB because USB can control both mouse and keyboard, and one video. So that's a total of 5, 7 cables. So you understand what's going on. Think of it as a central switch box that the computer, each computer is hooked to via its display out, whatever that is, and its keyboard mouse out with USB. And so that's two from each computer. And then it itself has three cables out, mouse, keyboard, and monitor that go to your mouse, your keyboard, and your monitor.
What is
Y
and output?
iogear.com. Hold on a second. I can see you have more questions. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls right after this. All right. So what?
Why do you need a cable from the computer a cable for the keyboard from the computer to
the KVM switch?
Right.
Because the computer, you. Oh, I see what you're saying. No, you're right. You don't. I made it more complicated than it is. You need a. Wait a minute, let me think about this. No, you do, because the KVM switch has to communicate with the computer. So what's coming? So the USB coming out of the KVM switch to the computer is from switch to computer is telling it what your mouse and keyboard movements are, because you have to tell the computer that. And so
in other words, to the computer, the KVM switch is the keyboard.
Yes.
Aha.
Aha. And it's also the monitor, and the KVM is what decides which keyboard, which computer to route. It's a router routing the computers to the single keyboard, mouse, and monitor. You have one set of, so that's why I asked the question: does he want two computers with two computer monitors, or does he want two computers with one computer monitor? And you answered: he wants one monitor that control both computers. The KVM will do that.
Okay. Thank you so
You're
much.
You're welcome. iogear.com is the chat room. Do you have a favorite? That's always been my favorite. I don't know what we use here at the studios, but we use what do we use, John, for our KVM switch? Not that I would recommend it. It's kind of crazy. I've always used iogear. What do we use?
There's another company.
Oh, yeah. Ours is based on the network, which is not what I would recommend. You want a hardwire based, which you can do. Adder? Yeah, just you want to do IO gear. They're really the best. I've used them for years. So what you do, and the way it switches is there'll be a key press combo that on your keyboard that you go, and then it changes from Windows to Mac. It's actually a very good way of operating.
How's StarTech?
Don't know Star. Okay, somebody's saying StarTech in the chat room. So there you go. Snafu says that's what he's using, but it's expensive. I don't know. Let me see if Wirecutter has a recommendation. This is an old school way of doing it, frankly. I don't know. What's the best? I don't know.
Okay, what is
But StarTech would be one to look at. Do not get Belkin.
Okay.
Belkin basically relabels cheap Chinese gear. I would get IO gear. That's the one I'd get.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Good job.
Bye bye.
Thanks. Draco is the one we have. Uh-huh. Malfoy. Draco. Draco is the one. But that's.
IO gear is the one that we use in the rack.
Yeah, I like. So we're using IO gear in the rack. I've always liked IO gear.
Adder is what we use.
ADDR. Yeah. So, and Aten, A-T-E-N, is that what you're thinking of? Because they own IO gear. And I love Synergy, but Synergy's slow. Synergy uses your network and lets you have, two monitors, two computers, and one mouse and keyboard, which is a little weird. But you can move your mouse from screen to screen, and so you have a Windows. It's actually very cool. Yeah. Yeah, Skyposaurus uses Synergy. Yeah. The original Skyposaurus used Synergy. Yeah. Yeah. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. Line 4, Andrew, Manchester, New Hampshire. Hi, Andrew. Leo Laporte.
Well, hello, Leo Laporte.
Well, hello.
How are you?
I am well. How are you, sir?
Doing great.
I'll be better if I could recover these 8 Bitcoin.
You're getting there. So what, 80% now?
Yep.
Yeah, sounds good.
Good guess.
Hey, so I was calling about an issue I run into with several different computers. I do tech support for consumers. You might call me a geek. But basically what happens is the computer goes to sleep, and when it goes to wake up, you get just completely artifacted on the screen. It solves itself after it restarts.
Ah, but, interesting. It's not. So in other words, it's not syncing properly. Is it HDMI?
It's laptops, desktops. I've seen it on 6 different computers.
Oh, you mean it's not an external monitor? It's the monitor on the laptop?
Yep, even on the laptop.
It's confused when it wakes up. And I bet you it's Windows, isn't it?
Windows 10 on all of them.
Why would it be confused upon wake up? And it doesn't ever resolve. It's just all broken up, and then it stays that way till you reboot?
Until you reboot it, yep.
Well, that's nuts.
I figured out the solution, but I was wondering if you could...
I've never seen it. And I've not heard about it. It's interesting. You're seeing it in multiple situations.
On Acer, Dell, Asus, and Lenovo.
Are you using Hibernate or sleep?
It is sleep, yep.
Okay. So we all know that Hibernate is a bad choice for Windows machines. It gets them very confused. The difference in Hibernate and sleep is Hibernate saves out the contents of memory to a disk and then really shuts down 100%. It goes to almost 0 watts. And then when you open the lid, it has to reload memory and start it up again. And that often is confusing for Windows. Windows has a hard time with Hibernate. In fact, many cases will just disable Hibernate. It might even come from the factory that way. So you're using sleep, which is a low power but not a no power mode, where the RAM continues to be refreshed. So you close the lid, the screen turns off, the RAM continues to be refreshed. So in theory, when you open it up, all that has to happen is the screen turns on, the CPU comes up to full power, and you should be able to continue working where you left off. Does the same thing happen if the screen goes out with the lid open?
Yes.
Okay.
If you just hit sleep in the power settings and then go to wake it back up.
Same thing. Wow. So what that's saying is, for some reason, the screen is getting out of sync and can't resync itself, which is very interesting. No, I've never seen this. What was your solution?
It usually requires a BIOS update from the manufacturer.
Okay. So an out-of-date BIOS. That's interesting.
Yeah, it was a very confusing thing, and I was just like, well...
Anybody in the chat room see this behavior? I mean, I have a lot of Windows 10 machines. And I have yet to see this happen. So it's interesting that it's happened so much to you. Are these customers using older computers that weren't made for Windows 10?
The newest one we've seen is from 2016.
That's pretty new.
But most of them have been a little bit older, yeah.
And the display driver obviously is up to date and so forth.
Yep, that was the first option we tried, but they were still experiencing the issue after that.
Boy, I mean, we have, 500 or 600 people in the chat room, Lawn Dog, for instance, who says, I have 8 Windows 10 machines, have never seen that happen. So it's interesting that it's happening so much to you. I'm not blaming you, Andrew. I'm not blaming you. But I'm wondering if there's something there's some common factor with your customers, like they're all using Windows 7 PCs that they've upgraded to Windows 10 or something like that. Well, the BIOS update, that's good news that works. What about the 2016 model? Did the BIOS update work for that?
Yeah, same thing worked for that. It was just a very interesting problem. I was like,
so I have one theory. I have one theory. The next time this happens, instead of updating the BIOS, clear the non-volatile system configuration data, the ESCD. You know about that?
Yeah, yeah.
So it stores modern computers store the extended system configuration data, ESCD, in the non-volatile CMOS memory. And so when it first gets set up at the factory and the operating system gets put on, it stores, this is the kind of hard drive, this is the kind of display I have. And if that data were corrupted or out of date, that could conceivably give you this issue. Because what it sounds like is a refresh sync rate mismatch. What does the screen look like? Is it tearing?
We've seen a couple different things, but it's usually just like multicolored, kind of like snow TV.
So most BIOSes, I don't know about newer BIOSes. This might be an older thing, but most in the old days, the BIOSes had a reset ESCD data switch in the BIOS. And what it would do is would refresh it. It would go out. It would do what you do when you first install the computer, build the computer. It would go out and say, well, let me see what we got. And I'd just be curious as a diagnostic if that – because the same thing would happen with a BIOS update, of course. First thing you do is you start over. So I'm wondering if that might be a short-term way. Now, if the BIOS is out of date, you should do it anyway.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, especially you. I wouldn't recommend this to end users because it's risky if you lose power during a BIOS update. You brick the computer, things like that. But you're a sophisticated IT professional. You're going to be careful about all this. So it's not a bad idea to do the BIOS update. The other thing you might try, this is a good point, maybe your customers go into BIOS and tweak it. And so maybe reset. Maybe the thing to do is before updating the firmware, you go into the system setup. We shouldn't really call it BIOS. BIOS is going away. It's EFI in most cases. UEFI. Yeah. So go into the setup. We'll just call it setup, and reset to defaults and refresh the ESCD and see. I'm curious if that would do it in lieu of a firmware update. Now, if the firmware's out of date, that's the first thing you should do anyway. As a your support guy, that's the first thing you want to do is make sure everything's up to date. Very interesting. There's got to be something going on. Did you set up these machines initially?
Not as far as we know, no.
Okay, so it's not like some software that you routinely put on the machine or something like that. It's just, let's put it this way. You did, and this, by the way, is the main, I know people like us, who we know everything, don't usually call tech support, because tech support usually is more clueless than we are. But the one good thing tech support can offer is a large data set of experience with this particular hardware. So by calling me, that's in effect what you're getting is this normal? And the response I'm giving you is, we've not seen this, and nobody in the chat room's seen this. I haven't seen it. So it is something unique, and I'm not sure what the common factor is, except that it's you, Andrew. Not something you're doing, but something about those machines you're getting. Either they're out of date, or the ESCD is corrupted, or something's going on that's telling it, this is a different refresh rate on the monitor, or this is a different kind of monitor. So I think your trick of firmware update is probably enough to fix it. But you might just if you want to really figure this out, try refreshing the system settings to the default and clearing the ESCD. Leo Laporte, hey, thanks for the call, though. Interesting puzzle. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And I wonder, and is it, they're all coming in with this as their presenting problem?
Yeah, it's not exactly for like two of them, but the other four, that was the issue they were experiencing. So
I said, why is this happening, Andrew? And you said, I don't know.
First time we thought it was a hardware issue, so we sent it out to be repaired. Then I was like, oh no, a BIOS update fixed it. So
yeah, so it's a driver or software configuration issue. Interesting.
Yeah.
I like it that the BIOS worked. That was a good, that was a good test to see if the BIOS refresh would fix it. And in these cases, was the BIOS out of date?
Okay. Every case that has been out of date.
Okay. Out of date BIOS. You know, it might be something about people in New Hampshire. They don't like to update their BIOS.
That doesn't surprise me. They're getting
a lot of worried
about the BIOS.
not going to update the BIOS. That's trouble.
Nah.
No.
That is too hard for most people.
Yes, exactly. Anyway. That's why I suggest that you be the person that does that, not, good. Well, I don't know if we've come up with it. Oh, that's another question. Somebody's saying, are all these machine discrete graphics or motherboard graphics, Intel Iris graphics? Or
all of them so far have been motherboard graphics.
They're all Intel graphics.
Yep.
Which you would think would be the most compatible.
That's what I would think. Yeah. Intel's usually pretty good about that.
Yeah. We know at least that Microsoft wouldn't break it with any Windows updates, as there's just too many machines that way with that. Very interesting.
I was wondering if it was more of a Microsoft issue or maybe a specific kind of motherboard issue.
Do you get a lot of power outages in Manchester?
Well, not yet, but, you know, the snow just started falling.
Brownouts? I'm just trying to find a common, you know, some common thread here. And maybe those would have clobbered the BIOS or something. I don't know. That's really interesting. I just don't know. But you're doing them. Well, I love it. And if people, you know, somebody may call and say, oh, yeah, I know that. I've had that happen to me many times. I know exactly what that is. So keep listening. Hey, it's nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too, Leo.
Thanks, Andrew. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Interesting question, huh? He said all kinds of brands. There was Acer's in there, but it was not one brand. Now, just an update. I'm at 86% of scanning my Bitcoin wallet, Johnny Jet. If I get $100,000 in Bitcoin here, I could travel anywhere in the world. Johnny Jet is here, our travel guru. He helps us use technology to travel better. And that's technology, finding your Bitcoin wallet and seeing what's in it, blowing the moths out.
Yeah, but almost 100,000 Bitcoin?
Oh, no. If I had 100,000 Bitcoin, I'd be gone. I have almost eight Bitcoin, but that's a current value. It's worth $112,000.
Eight Bitcoin?
Yeah.
What was I thinking?
And the funny thing is, I had forgotten about it. Well, I kind of knew it was there somewhere, but I didn't know where. And actually, if it's still unknown if I'm going to recover it. I found the old wallet. The wallet with the dust in it from 2013. Wow. And all you need is your wallet because the wallet doesn't have any money in it with Bitcoin. The wallet just has your crypto key, your personal private crypto key. And so I'm running it through the register right now of every Bitcoin transaction ever, because that's what you store on your drive. Every Bitcoin transaction ever. And then it will, in a minute, in 12%. It will tell me how much Bitcoin I've got. Then this step two would be to see if I can unlock the wallet. That will be the
So first. How much did you buy the eight?
I didn't buy any of it. It's all been donated. At one point, we asked people on the website if, you know, they wanted to donate. You could do it in dollars, but we gave them our Bitcoin address, and they could donate that way back in 2012 or something. And
I'm going to start.
But that's when Bitcoin was nothing. People were giving me a dime. They were giving me 15 cents. Little did they know. Here we go. Fast forward to almost 2018.
Incredible.
It's worth a lot more money.
Incredible.
Well, all right, John.
First of all, I want to thank you for giving me a tip. Actually, one of your shows before I went on, I heard you telling someone with an iPhone to clean out the bottom in case you can't charge. And my dad's phone was not charging. And I brought it to Apple and to Sprint, and they were like, you're going to have to buy a new phone. And I was like, you know what? And all of a sudden, I just remembered.
They didn't just take some canned air and blow it out? They didn't even do that?
And so we did it, and it's fine now.
Yeah, because
Pocket. And that's how he communicates. He's 89 years old, and he can't hear, really.
Pocket lint gets caught in the lightning port of all phones, and you just a little compressed air, not too much, just pulse it in there.
Right.
Often
enough. Well, I brought it back to Apple, and then they brushed it out and stuff, and they go, try it, and it worked.
Oh, so you said to them, hey, have you checked this?
Yeah, but Sprint first wanted me to buy a whole new phone, and I was like,
of course they do. They don't care.
No.
It's just time for a new phone.
So anyway, you saved me $400 at least.
Well, there you go. Thank you, Johnny Jet.
Well, thank you. And here's a quick tip, by the way. If anyone is flying Alaska Airlines on Friday,
yes,
if you wear an ugly sweater, holiday sweater, you can cut the line and board first. So that's pretty cool.
Okay, this Friday only.
Yeah, December 15th.
Do you have any ugly Christmas sweaters?
Well, I have my. I'm kind of wearing my ugly necklace right now.
You're wearing some lights, but. I've got to get some because there are lots of uses for ugly Christmas sweaters. Things like this.
Yeah, for sure.
I've been invited today to an ugly Christmas sweater party and chili cook-off. But wow. I don't have an ugly sweater to wear.
Well, go on Amazon. I'm sure you can find one pretty quick.
Yeah. Can I get it today? That's the question.
Yeah.
All right, so that's tip number one.
All right. Now I have a website for you. So, you know, one of the big things to do is to rent an apartment or a house. But a lot of people don't feel comfortable renting someone else's, like, you know, through peer-to-peer, like Airbnb.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you hear horror stories, although I've had good experiences. But, you know, once in a while I'll see on Twitter one of my friends say, their Airbnb host canceled last minute and they're screwed.
Yeah.
So if you want to rent a house but don't want to go through Airbnb or someone like that, check out this site called Vacasa. I'm pronouncing it wrong. V-A-C-A-S-A. Vacasa is probably how it's pronounced.
I know people have used Vacasa and love it.
Okay, good. I have not used it. They have 5,100 vacation homes around the country and Central and South America. And you can get anything from between a beach cottage to a ski chalet. And you're going through private homeowners. But these guys are the management company to make sure that, you know, no one cancels on you last minute, that if you can't find the keys, you won't be locked out, or if you lose the keys. And I used a similar company once called Paris Perfect in Paris, where you get an apartment.
Oh,
and
it looks so
amazing.
Nice.
Yeah. And it's really nice because, you know, one time I rented an Airbnb and they're like, the keys are underneath the grill over here. And I went looking for them. I couldn't find them. But with like this other company, Paris Perfect, I'm sure Vacasa is the same, where they'll have it in the lockbox or someone will greet you.
They have a better, in other words, the management company is better.
Yes.
Because a lot of Airbnb people are just doing it themselves. But the ones that are more, you know, serious about it will have a management company. They'll be a little bit better run.
It will be more expensive,
but it's
most
more expensive,
likely.
Yeah, because you got to pay for the management.
So, you know, you're paying for that peace of mind. But again, I'm not throwing Airbnb under the bus or HomeAway or VRBO. They're all great. My brother rents his house in Nantucket on those. And, you know, he has always had great experiences and he provides that. So I would just find one that has, you know, really good reviews. And if you like one, stick with one.
VACASA.com.
Yeah. So I'm glad you know people that have done it.
Love it.
Okay, good. So we got time for my app?
Yeah.
All right. So this one is called CoolCousin.com is the website, but it's a free app on iOS and Android.
I don't know. I mean, if I were going to guess, I don't know what that would be. Cool Cousin. Is that to find dates in foreign cities?
They say that, you know, everyone wishes they had a cool cousin in a certain city to tell them where to go.
Right. Of course.
So this one, they're in 56 cities around the world. And, you know, you kind of, if you're doing research to find places what to do, you can see different people, what they like, what their habits are, and then their recommendations. So that if you like, you know, if you think you have the same interests, you can follow their recommendations. You know, it doesn't cost anything, and they'll just tell you this is, you know, the best bar to drink at or the best restaurant.
So I've used like tours by locals where you actually pay a lot of money, maybe a few hundred dollars for a tour from a local. This isn't that. This is an app that will actually just give you the tips on the phone. You don't have to pay anything.
For sure, but I think tours by local is a much better
way
to
go. Yeah, yeah. But this will get you started.
For sure. I mean, it's just another thing, a way to research. So I don't know how great it is, but instead of trying to find everyone's blog, hopefully people will read mine, and recommendations. But if you don't, you know, check out these guys and see what you think.
I think it's a nice idea. CoolCousin.
I like the name. I really like the name. Yeah.
And you can get an app on your phone, or is this just a website? It looks like
it's an app.
It's an app too. Okay, good.
Yeah.
CoolCousin.com. Johnny is our cool cousin.
Actually, it's only on iOS. It looks like. Okay. Doesn't look like it's on Android.
Not unusual. Yeah. Johnny is he's got all the travel skinny, all the info, and he just fills us in. You're going to wear those lights around your neck on your next travel adventure?
No, but my son loves them, so I just had him.
Daddy is a Christmas tree. Are you staying home for the holidays?
No, I'm getting on a plane next Friday, actually.
You is it too
late? I'm going to wear my ugly holiday sweater.
Too late to book a trip somewhere? Is it going to be just through the roof?
No, it's not too late. Actually, I have on my website, I have 10 ways to find cheap flights. So if you're not flexible, you're not going to really find a good deal. But if you are, you can definitely find one. I'm actually booking a ticket today for my dad to get out of town.
Nice.
And I just good looked. And there are ways to find cheap tickets. You just have to sniff them out.
Or go to johnnyjet.com and get his travel newsletter, travel deals newsletter. Follow him on Twitter at Johnny Jet. He's always talking about great travel deals. And, of course, pictures of his travels on his Instagram, Johnny Jet. Thanks, Johnny. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More tech calls coming up. Very nice. Very cool.
So before I let you go, by the way, have you ever been in a self-driving car?
Self-driving car. Well, besides the you know, like a real self-driving car?
Yeah.
No, I have not. Have you?
No, but I see that Lyft is just starting them in Boston. They're offering rides right now, and I was going to mention it.
They still have a safety driver, which is probably more for personal, you know,
comfort
than really needed. But gosh, Boston is crazy to drive in. I'm not sure I'd want to drive in Boston.
I know.
With a self-driving
car. I drove last
car.
Summer in Boston.
It's the hardest city to drive in America, I think. Because the streets
are bad.
Well, this, you know why? Because it's one of the oldest cities. The older the city, the crazier
it is. DC, the streets are numbered really funky and they're one
way. Yeah, but at least they're numbered and gridded. And the same thing in New York.
Yeah.
But Boston, it's like everything's like this and you go one way and then suddenly it's the other way. And it's just crazy in Boston. I don't like to drive in Boston, as you might have gathered. So right. I don't know. That would be a very good test for a self-driving car. This is a Lyft is doing this, right? So you may call a Lyft and you'd get a self-driving car.
Yeah. And but there will be a safety driver, as you said.
Can you opt out?
I would assume so. You just cancel the ride. But when I was in Japan a week and a half ago, I was on a golf course and they had self-driving golf carts.
What?
And
that's a little easier, right? Because that's just the golf.
Yeah. So I took a tour of the golf course in a self-driving golf cart. They're like, don't touch the steering wheel or the gas pedal or the brake. If you want to stop, just press the button. And I went all around the golf course. It stays on the path. That's why the courses are so nice. And, you know, they said they've had it for a couple of years. And, you know, in Japan, it's pretty common. And I was like, wow, man, this is awesome.
That's a safer place to do it. I mean, if you're going to drive into a tree, at least you're going so slowly you could jump out of the golf cart.
Yeah. Well, it's a little jerky. What's well? I remember going down these steep hills, and all of a sudden, it's still a pretty cool thing.
Johnny, have a great. Where are you going? You're not going to tell us.
I can't tell you, but
I'll be somewhere
next week.
You're bringing the family, obviously.
Of course.
Yeah,
of course.
And that'll cover Christmas too, or you could come back before Christmas.
You'll have to wait and see.
Oh yeah, singing the blues. I lost my Bitcoin wallet. It had 8 Bitcoins in it. And I don't know where it went. I got the Bitcoin, lost my wallet blues, baby. 8888 Ask Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 98% scanned. I'm a little nervous. This is the Al Capone's vault for the tech guy. I found my old Bitcoin wallet from 2013. Actually, I have several backups because I was told, back up your wallet, but keep it safe because if somebody gets your wallet, they could steal your coin. So I backed it up to my secure server. It's backed up. But I, you know, there's going to be one more step where we're rescanning it, which means it's going through all the Bitcoin transactions over the last 10 years, matching it up to the secret number, see which ones are mine. And we're going to see if this comes up. It should come up with about 7.8 Bitcoin. If it does, then the next step will be, can I remember my password? The funny thing is they estimate about one-third of all Bitcoin. Recent transactions may not yet be visible. Connecting to peers, synchronizing with the network. Oh, my. 7.85 Bitcoin are in the wallet. Al Capone's vault is not empty. Now the hard part. Will I remember the password? So this is a little lesson. So if with 7.85 Bitcoin, and Bitcoin's currently, it went down. It went up to as high as $20,000 over the last couple of days. With 7.85 Bitcoin, let me do some calculations here. 7.85 times, what is it now? It's roughly $14,000. That's $110,000 real money. If I can unlock it. Imagine that. That's the total value of Bitcoin is about $242 billion. That's how much Bitcoin has been generated. But it's estimated that more than $80 billion of that is just lost. Nobody knows. A good chunk of it belongs to the guy who invented Bitcoin, the guy or guys or gals, Satoshi Nakamoto. He disappeared. We haven't heard hide or hair of him for years, like 4 or 5 years. And nobody's touched his Bitcoin trove, which is worth billions of dollars. You'd think if he was alive, he'd maybe have cashed in a little bit of that. Of course, the minute anybody touches these, they'll know. Satoshi's alive. Satoshi's alive. So I probably just woke somebody up. Leo's alive. Leo's alive. So I'm good. I found my wallet. That's part one. People lose their wallets. I have a friend, good friend, has a wallet with 50 bitcoins. That's worth more than $500,000. $500,000, and he doesn't know where it is because it's just a little tiny file. And he didn't carefully, you know. I know people, they put it on USB keys. Oh, this is, you know, we got to keep it safe, and then lost the USB key. Imagine if you had a wallet with $500,000 in it, and you just misplaced it. That's kind of what this is like. I'm not going to enter that password. I'm too nervous about that. 8888-ASK-LEO. I don't want to know. I do not want to know. Let's go back to the phones. Doug, well, I will. Before the show's over, I'll try some passwords. Doug in Ohio, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Doug. Oh, wait a minute. Let me press this button. There you go. Hi, Doug. What can I do for you?
Hello.
Today? Hello.
Yeah. I have a laptop, a Toshiba laptop with a Windows 8 on it that I use for running a HP 4550 printer that we run about 10,000 sheets through a month.
Okay.
It just did an update, and it destroyed my drivers for that printer. It still says it's Windows 8. It didn't go to 10 because 10 doesn't have the drivers for that printer.
Yeah. Last week somebody calls it. I have an HP printer. Doesn't work with Windows 10. But what is the printer? How old is the printer?
Oh, it's probably 15 years old.
Oh, it's that old. Yeah.
It's 2.5 cents per page color printing, so that's why I run it. And it's, you know, four pages.
Have you gone to the HP driver page just to see if by some stretch of the imagination there are drivers, updated drivers there for it?
I haven't. I mean, this was, I didn't change. In other words, this laptop has been the 8 Windows 8, and it's been working with it. I didn't change anything except when it did the update. My printer was gone, and the drivers weren't showing.
Well, so understand, the drivers come from HP. When, you know, what a driver is, a small file created by the manufacturer of the hardware to... it's basically a translator to talk to Windows. And so the manufacturer, when they make a printer or a mouse or any variety of things, they make a driver that says, this is how you print. This is how you do this. This is how you do that. And when you put that driver on Windows, Windows doesn't talk to the printer. It talks to the driver. The driver translates for the printer. But it is up to the manufacturer to keep that driver up to date. And it's not unusual, especially with something that old, that a manufacturer might say, well, we'll support through Windows Vista, but we're not going any farther than that. So at some point, something happened. Maybe your drivers got damaged. Maybe they got corrupted. Or maybe an update clobbered them, but it's no longer working. The only recourse, the one and only, well, there's several. Okay, I shouldn't be so glum. I mean, you should immediately go to HP.com, and you'll go to their customer support page for software and driver downloads, and you can enter your product name, product number, or best serial number from the printer and see what the latest driver is. Mm-hmm. And if with any luck, there'll be a Windows 7 or 8 driver. Okay. The 7 should work as well. With any luck, you just reinstall, you'll download them and install them just as you would any driver, and the thing will work. However, if it doesn't, then there are some choices for generic drivers or universal drivers. There's a system that Linux uses, because a whole lot of people used printers on Linux that there was never a printer driver made. Most companies say, I'm not going to make one for Linux. I'll make it for Windows. I'll maybe make it for Macintosh, but not going to do it for Linux. So on Linux, they use something called the Common Unix Printing System, or CUPS. And these are drivers written by users to make it work with Linux. And you can put, I'm pretty sure you could put CUPS on your Windows machine. Maybe not, but I bet you can. And if not, there is something called the Universal Print Driver. The issue with both of these is you're not going to get all the features of your printer, but you might get enough features. Yeah. The problem really is going to be the color part, right? But if you go to the HP site, they have a universal print driver that is designed for HP printers. I guess this is how they, you know, make people feel better about what they when they stop supporting. So that's the other thing to search for is HP universal print driver, and cross your fingers. It should work. My guess is, especially since it was working, something, you know, either you did a Windows update that broke it or more likely it got damaged. Download the latest ones and you should be all right. But it's something people need to be aware of anytime you update a computer or you update an operating system. The one catch is going to be, well, the biggest catch anyway, is going to be hardware compatibility, because it's up to the hardware manufacturers to make sure that that works. And even Microsoft and Apple at some point say, well, you know, we're not going to support it anymore. Microsoft did that with Windows XP. There's not going to be any more updates for Windows XP. It's end of life. Vista's next. Vista might already, actually, I think Vista has reached its end of life. And then next will be literally Windows 7. None of these last forever. Because you understand, a company can't really be expected to keep everything working forever. Printers, not uncommon. But at least HP offers this universal print driver. That would be worth trying. It will at least, what it does is it goes out and it says discovers HP devices and some non-HP devices and communicates with them, says, what can you do? What are you capable of? And attempts to make it work. This is actually a good idea on HP's part. And in a way, that's kind of their response to out-of-date hardware. But a 15-year-old printer, that's not unusual. In fact, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a 15-year-old printer probably does not hook up to the computer via USB. It's probably hooking up via a parallel port, is it? you must have some sort of USB interface to it. Otherwise, my goodness, that really would be antiquated. 8888 Ask Leo, the number. If you have a comment, a question, or maybe an answer to this particular conundrum, you can also visit us at our website. That's always open. There's no sign up. It's completely free. TechGuyLabs.com. TechGuyLabs.com. More of your calls right after this. Our show today brought to you by my cup of Joe. My favorite cup of Joe. Blue Bottle Coffee. You've heard me talk about Blue Bottle. Everybody in San Francisco kind of loves the Blue Bottle. It is the coffee of choice in the city that loves coffee so much. It's so delicious, so flavorful. You will never drink a bland, boring cup of Joe again. And this is a great time to become a Blue Bottle customer because they have a subscription service. The world's most delicious, sustainable coffee, 85% certified organic, fresh. Baby, it's so fresh. When you place your order, your beans are roasted within 48 hours and it's shipped directly to you. So they actually put a freshness date right on the label so you know. And I'll tell you what, fresh beans make all the difference. You don't want some dusty old bean. You don't want to go down to the local coffee shop and buy beans that have been on the shelf for 3 months. No, you want beans, you know, that are practically warm and, oh, so fragrant. And what's fun about this, they have a subscription plan, a bi-monthly subscription plan. So every other week you get coffee. And that's fun, too, because they have coffee. They have single farm varietals. They have blends. This here, I just got the Ethiopia Hembella Estate Buku. Let me read you this. I love this card that it comes with. They even have a picture of the farm. In Ethiopia's coffee lands, Hembella Estates supports its community of workers and their families with uncommon devotion. In the specialty world, Hembella's exemplary washed and natural coffees have set new standards for the famed Guji Zone. I don't know what any of that means. The estate grows its own cherry, but it also outsources from surrounding neighborhoods. The Buku is one such coffee. That's the one here. Named for the farmers in the Buku neighborhood who contribute ruby red cherry. Dry processing often makes for round, syrupy, and unctuous coffee. This one, however, reveals such delicacy and clarity that both the senses and the mind exclaim with delight. If the coffee tree were a tone wood, a kind of wood that carries sound waves well, then the indigenous Arabica trees of Buku would play wind-blown songs all year long. And then they give you a little description, blueberry, vanilla, coriander seed. Well, let me tell you, you can smell it, you can taste it. This is delicious. Mmm. BlueBottleCoffee.com, BlueBottleCoffee.com/TechGuy. Save $10 off your first coffee subscription order. And what a great gift for a housewarming. You're going to a Christmas party. You're going to visit family and friends. What a great gift. Bring a little Blue Bottle with you. BlueBottleCoffee.com/TechGuy. $10 off your first coffee subscription order. They have a great digital holiday store, too. BlueBottleCoffee.com/TechGuy. Stop drinking average, ordinary coffee. Start drinking the best coffee, the freshest coffee. Blue Bottle. Coffee.com/TechGuy. It's all we drink. All we drink. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, and Bitcoin. What is the current? Now, I wonder how many of you have been sitting on Coinbase or one of the other Bitcoin exchanges and just watching the price of Bitcoin go up and down. How many of you? Currently, roughly, and different exchanges list different values, $14,876 for Bitcoin. That's almost $15,000. It was up to $20,000 per Bitcoin. And there's, of course, the higher it goes, the more crazy speculation happens, right? And that's what ramps it up even higher. So it was enough. It got high enough that I tempted to see if I could find my old Bitcoin. So I looked back on my backups, and there it is, lo and behold, a file called wallet.dat. That's the key. It's not a very big file, just a few kilobytes. It's literally the key, the crypto key, because Bitcoin uses public key cryptography for its exchanges. So you have a private key, which you keep completely secret to yourself. And then you have public keys, and you can make many public keys, which you give out. If somebody wants to give you money, you say, well, here's my key, my public key. And they send money to that Bitcoin wallet, and it gets stored in the wallet. But you can only access the coin in your wallet with the private key. Well, I've been able to recover my wallet and run it through the transaction. It was kind of like the Al Capone's vault. I felt like Geraldo Rivera. But unlike Geraldo, there was something in the vault. About $100,000 worth of Bitcoin. Eight Bitcoin in there. But of course, I, being the tech guy, was very smart. I was half smart. I encrypted my wallet because it is possible for somebody to steal your wallet. If they get access to that wallet.dat file and it's not encrypted, it's not protected, they could just take what's in it, transfer it to their wallet. Bye-bye. You'll never find it again. It's happened many times. There've been some big Bitcoin heists even over the last few days. I was smart enough not to put it into a public Bitcoin exchange. I think a lot of people in the early days used something called Mt. Gox. They put their money in Mt. Gox. What could be wrong with Mt. Gox? It's a mountain after all. Mt. Gox was the place to exchange Bitcoin and to store your Bitcoin. In fact, in 2014, it was handling 70% of all the Bitcoin transactions in the world. 1 month later, February 2014, it suspended trading, closed its website, and filed for bankruptcy. 850,000 bitcoins missing, likely stolen. Some of those found. But basically, if you'd stored your Bitcoin in Mt. Gox thinking this is a bank, you would have lost them. Probably hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, lost with the Mt. Gox bankruptcy. That didn't stop it, though. People still bought Bitcoin. And I was half smart, as I said. I kept my wallet secure. I stored it on my own local servers. I encrypted it. I see it right here. I've got it. I had a good backup, so I have it. I see my 7.85 Bitcoin, but here's the problem. I don't remember. What was the passphrase I used to encrypt it? I don't remember. I don't remember. So that's my job over the next few days. That's a pretty good incentive. 7.85 Bitcoin, more than $100,000. I don't think so. I'll be honest. I don't think I'm going to touch it. I'd love to be able to decrypt it knowing that I could someday touch it. But I think might as well leave it in there. And there's a risk that it'll go to nothing. There's a risk that it'll go to something. There's a risk I'll never get my password. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. I didn't store it in LastPass. And I was using LastPass then. So that tells me I probably used something I know. Like, you know, my PGP key or something. I'll find it. I hope. Ernesto on the line from Pismo Beach. Hello, Ernesto. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I think you should invest into CryptoKitties.
Have you been following that story? That is wild.
Yeah, a little bit.
$1 million spent on virtual cats. They have no value, no intrinsic value, but their price is going up. The most expensive one is $112,000. And the reason is the theory is you could sell. What? I know. You could sell it to somebody else for $130,000 and make money. And some people are making money, but you got to wonder what is going on in this world?
Hey, I guess that's the future.
Or the past. It's something. What's up with your world?
I have a question about, I need a cell phone for my pops. All he does is talk on the phone. He doesn't text. He doesn't use data. I mean, as far as the internet. And he doesn't talk much. So a prepaid one. But here's the thing. He travels from the United States to Mexico. And he just wants a cell phone that's going to work here and there.
Yeah.
Without even, you know.
Good news is, because it's not a smartphone, he doesn't need a smartphone, he just needs a phone.
Nope.
The good news is it'd be a very easy and inexpensive purchase. When my daughter went to Mexico for a year as a student, we got her a phone in Mexico, a cheap Alcatel, that's a French phone company, phone with a SIM card, and she used it in Mexico. She could bring it back to the States. Now, the issue is he wants to be able to use it in both the U.S. and Mexico, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Without any issues, just fly there, fly back, and just, you know,
so
for us to call him.
He could go. You could go right now. You can go today to a T-Mobile store and say, I want they call these feature phones. They really should call them dumb phones, right? But they call them feature phones. You can get a really cheap, probably free feature phone. The reason I say go to T-Mobile is because T-Mobile's fairly inexpensive. You can get a pay-as-you-go phone. And T-Mobile offers free international data. I know you don't care about that. And fairly inexpensive international calls without any fuss. You don't have to call them up and say, I'm going to Mexico. They just do it.
Yeah.
And since he doesn't talk a lot, you're not going to be too worried. I think it was 20 cents a minute. So it's very inexpensive. So he talks for 5 minutes, it's a dollar. And that's a kind of a pay-as-you-go thing, and I think a very good way to go. It works well. In the U.S., T-Mobile is a strong company in the U.S. and the number three cell company. I wouldn't go to Verizon, and even AT&T. If you're going to start using overseas, you have to call them and say, "I need an international plan." I mean, you can do that. You could turn on an international plan, but I like the idea of travel, go wherever you want. It works in about 190 countries. Mexico absolutely is one of them.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. The no fuss thing about it is what I'm.
I agree.
For,
you don't have to tell them ahead of time. And
exactly.
I think I'm pretty sure it's 20 cents a minute. It's inexpensive enough that I don't really pay attention to it because I'm like your dad. I don't use the phone much. It's more like an emergency thing, so somebody can reach him. He'll have a U.S. number that'll work in Mexico.
Cool.
All right.
Thanks for your work, Leo. Thanks.
My pleasure. I love it. And yeah, this is as I said. A simple thing to go into T-Mobile, explain to them. They'll try to upsell you probably. I mean, I would. Oh, no, he's going to want a smartphone. He's going to want maps. He's going to want texting. He's going to, no, he doesn't. Texting, international texting is free, unlimited. And I think, I'm trying to remember, but I think phone calls are 20 cents. Now, you can go to AT&T, as I said, but you'd then be paying for an international plan on a regular basis. And I just like the idea that T-Mobile doesn't make you do anything. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number if you have a suggestion. I always remember, I should mention, I always do when people talk about traveling with smartphones, a great wiki called Prepaid with Data that will tell you every country in the world what smartphones work, what data plans you can get there, local data plans and so forth. Just Google Prepaid with Data wiki, W-I-K-I, and you'll find that. More of your calls coming up right after this. They're saying AT&T is best in Mexico. That I don't know about. I think Gabby was using AT&T in Mexico, as I remember. But you have to arrange a plan, right? You have to use their international plan. I know so many people are crying over their Bitcoin wallets. Bitcoin hits $20,000 a coin this week. It's made up. It's imaginary. You know, one thing nobody talks about with Bitcoin is the amount of energy it takes to generate these Bitcoins is phenomenal. It's huge. In fact, and it was always created this way. It was intended to get harder and harder to make Bitcoin, and that there'll be a point at which all the Bitcoin that is going to ever be made will be made. I think in a few years we're going to reach that point, and that's it. But in the meantime, it gets a little bit more, the cryptographic problems, the mathematical problems that are being solved to generate Bitcoin get harder and harder and harder. This is intentional. And as a result, if you want to mine Bitcoin, you not only need to get a very powerful rig, usually nowadays a rig designed with specialized chips specifically for Bitcoin, and they generate a lot of heat and they use a ton of power. So almost all the Bitcoin being generated these days, all of it is being generated, if it's going to make any sense economically, generated in places where the power is free or cheap. Much of it in China, in little shops next to hydroelectric dams. So it's, in a sense, it's an environmental nightmare because it's using so much energy, but the energy supply from these hydroelectric dams is virtually infinite. It's not like it's being wasted exactly. My guess is it's quasi-governmental people doing this, and they're not paying anything for the money. It's kind of an amazing phenomenon. I know I'm overdoing it, but it's just been in all the news lately. Just fascinating. Going to line one, Greg in Pasadena. Hello, Greg.
Hey, how are you, Leo?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing good. I hope you find your password.
I know. You know, honestly, don't really care. It was free money anyway. What can I do for you today?
Good way to look at it. Hey, I have a Logitech Group video conference system.
Yeah.
And I want to put the camera a little further down the room than the cable they gave me allows. And I thought I could make an extension cable. The cable that they provide looks like a PS2 cable.
Oh.
Has a mini DIN 6-pin connector at each end. I ohmed them out, and it seems to be a straight through cable. In one goes to one, two to two, three to three, and so on.
Okay.
So I made my own extension cable. I took a PS2 cable, I cut it, I spliced in a longer piece, one to one, two to two, three to three, and so on. I kept the shield intact, just like they said. So it ohms out correctly. It seems to map out correctly. But when I plug it in, it says a USB device not recognized. When I went online to Logitech, they sell a very expensive extension cable, but it's still not as long as I need. So my question is, other than being a straight through one to one, two to two cable, and again, we're only talking 6 pins, what is there any magic circuitry built into the
cable? Yeah, there might be. You look at the cables you've got, and what you're going to look for is a little bump or a hump, the kind of thing you'd see in a boa constrictor that just had dinner.
Well, it does have a molded ferrite bead at each end.
Yeah, the bead could just be for a crosstalk, but it also is possible if it's actually bonded into the cable that there's a chip in there, and that's what concerns me. That, you know, they're selling these extension cables for a lot of money. They might well be incented to put a chip in there that prevents you from making your own.
Okay, what if I cut the existing professional cable, cut it in the middle, and spliced it?
That sounds like a good idea.
The chip's still at each end doing its thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only way I could think of that they would prevent you. I mean, you've already mapped out, you've used a voltmeter and made sure that every pin is straight through, and you've made sure that everything else is up to spec. The only other thing I could think of is some sort of copy protection scheme, and I wouldn't be surprised companies do this to keep you from using your own cables and make you buy these expensive proprietary cables. And the way that's usually done, in fact, the only way I could think of that that's done, is circuitry in either end or both ends that validates it, that says, yeah, there's a Logitech chip on the other end of this cable. It's not just a plain old cable. So I think your logic is correct. If you cut the proprietary cable and just extend those wires, there can't be anything in the wires or the shielding that's doing this. It has to be at either end.
Yeah, they're just copper wires. They're not magical.
Yeah, magical wires. And I can't think of any other way that they could copy protect it except with a little chip at either end.
Probably embedded in a ferrite bead. Because
it's either in the bead or, you know, it's not unusual when you look at a USB cable, there's a, you know, there's a little hump there where it's connecting. It's not unusual to put something in there.
These are the round PS2 style cables.
And it doesn't look like there's any room in there, huh?
No, it looks the same, exact same diameter as the PS2 cables, you know, we've seen for 20 years.
Well, I'll open it up to the chat room and to the electrical wizards. If you were going to design a cable, a PS2, well, first of all, they do it. That's why they do PS2 and not USB. They think, well, that'll stop some people because you can't just buy a USB extender cable. And if that doesn't work, then what would you do to make this proprietary and make it so that people like Greg, who's smart, can't just extend the cable? I think you're exactly right. Now, the risk is you're cutting into that proprietary cable.
And I'm actually doing this for a client, so I got to ask him before I cut his cable. Although it doesn't really serve him because it's just too short.
Yeah.
So there's that.
So East Coast Dave is pointing out you probably wouldn't be able to measure 0 ohms resistance if there were a chip in between.
Well, I guess use the continuity, you know, where I got a beep. I didn't check for
accuracy. Oh, okay. There's got to be a chip in there. And that's a cheap and easy thing for Logitech to do. It was the kind of thing we see all the time that makes a cable special.
Yeah, I did notice that the very long cable they sell, the 50-footer, it doesn't have that ferrite bead, which is like an inch or so in length. It's like 5 inches in length.
Well, they would have to have active circuitry in something that long, probably an amplifier. Yeah, I'm not familiar with the technology Logitech uses for these group cameras, but I'm looking at a picture of the cable and I see how expensive it is to buy an extension cable. It's not even long enough.
No.
This
goes through the floor, through some conduit, up to the ceiling, and then over to the camera. So it's like 80 feet.
Yeah, that boa constrictor hump on the cable does look like more than just a ferrite core. And it's only on one end, right? It's not on both ends.
No, it's on both.
Oh, it is. All right. That's almost certainly the copy protection right in there. So if you cut in between the two, they don't say on their spec sheet.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
I couldn't even get a pin out.
They don't show you that part. Yeah.
I was going to try to check the voltage, but if I put the voltage on the ground, I'm going to, you know, blow out the camera, and I don't want to do that either, so...
Yeah, and just looking at that, that's more than a ferrite core. That's not – so you put the ferrite core in, they could be little simple things. You used to be able to buy them at Radio Shack that just reduce crosstalk. That's bigger than that needs to be. It doesn't even look like a ferrite core. That looks like some proprietary technology in there. Yes, I think you're smart.
You're looking at the 50-foot cable?
The 10-meter cable, yeah.
Okay, yeah. They include a 10-foot cable with the camera.
I think you're right, but – don't yell at me if we're wrong. Anybody got a better idea? Let us know. Leo LaPointe, the tech guy. So my buddy, Patrick Norton, who is the king of hardware, he's our host of This Week in Computer. Does it stick? No, it doesn't stick. This Week in Computer Hardware on our Twit network and also his own show, TechZilla. Tech Thing. TechFang, TechThing.com. I gave him just... To look at this Eve crowdsourced computer. Pretty nice.
Yeah.
So the idea was they went to Indiegogo and they said, look, and this is true. Nowadays, when you get a computer, especially if you get it from Apple, but in general from any company, the company says, Well, we think this is what you want. And you don't have a whole lot of choice except you could buy a different model. That's your choice. So they said, why don't we go to Indiegogo, one of those crowdfunding sites, and ask people what they want to vote, and we'll design a computer that does what people ask for. And for instance, and I think this is obvious, the example is smartphones are getting thinner and thinner and thinner, but every time they get thinner, they get a smaller battery and lower battery life. And surprise, surprise, when people got to vote on their laptop, they said, we can take it a little bigger, a little thicker, a little bit heavier for a little bit better battery life. So they put a 45-watt battery in here, big old kilowatt battery. Gives it much, much better battery life. A beautiful screen. It looks a lot like a Microsoft Surface Pro. It's got a detachable keyboard. So it's a tablet plus. A little bit heavier. I don't think it's so heavy. It's got a kickstand that can even go all the way back to kind of one of the things I really like about the Microsoft Surface Studio, down to almost 15. This looks like maybe more like 20 degrees, which means it's almost like a draft board. Drafting table, I should say. I love the fact that it has a keyboard sensor. A fingerprint sensor on the on-off switch to unlock it very quickly but very securely. And best of all, Microsoft, which drives me crazy, has decided that they're going to stick with this Surface connector for power, which is a proprietary connector. And I love it that the industry, both phone and laptop, is moving towards Type-C connectors that are standard. And this uses that. What that means is I just plugged it into my, just kind of generic Type-C power adapter and it charged it up. And I love it. We're seeing that more and more with laptops. I wouldn't buy it. These days, I would not buy a laptop that didn't support Type-C charging. That's that no USB port or Thunderbolt port that's kind of, you could stick it in either way, up or down and it's data, it's video, it can do all sorts of things. But one of the things it can do, doesn't have to do, but can do, is charge. And I think the specification allows for up to 100-watt charging, which is pretty powerful. But it can, what you'd want with a laptop is a laptop that will charge, even if you've got a 10-watt charger, just charge very slowly. And it could go all the way up to whatever the maximum is, 100 watts. And you could use your charger at home and at work and just use inexpensive Type-C chargers, the same one you're using for your phone and your laptop. And that would be great. And that's what they did. So I admire that. Finnish company. I think it's an interesting idea. You can find out more if you search Indiegogo for Eve or go to eve-tech.com. This is a review unit that they sent us. But I think I might buy one. This is very nice. Very nicely done. And I love the idea, don't you, of letting users design, vote on the design. I love that idea. 8888 Ask Leah. We'll continue on to line 4. That's Rich in Tahunga, California. Hi, Rich. Did I press the button? Go ahead.
Yeah, I had a question I was going to call in with, but I experienced such issues while calling in. I'll save my other one for next year.
You can do them both if you want. Go ahead. I've been keeping you on hold for so long. Thank you.
No problem. I'm calling on an Android phone, and what I was running up against was I'm wondering if there's a good auto dialer app for Android. So if I'm calling the tech guy, I'm getting a busy signal.
Yeah.
And something that works faster than a human. I found some free apps out there, but it takes like 20 seconds from the time you hear the busy signal for it to initiate the redial, even if I set it at a 0-second redial. So I want something faster than a human. Do you know of anything for an Android?
I'm wondering if the reason that you get that delay is FCC regulations. Because, of course, as you might imagine, auto dialers could be used to harass.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know that, for instance, there are legal limits on how many times you can auto dial. And there, I wouldn't be surprised if there were, and I'll have to investigate this, limits on how fast you can redial for the same reason, to prevent harassment.
Okay.
Which one are you using? I'm looking at Auto Dialer from Smart Life Digital. Is that the one you're trying?
Yeah, I tried that one, and same issue. Yeah, 20
it
seconds.
It slows you down. I'm guessing that's intentional. I might be wrong, but I'm guessing the reason they do that is because they don't want to support people harassing other people. Now, I'm looking at a website called App Crawler where you can go and you can say, I want an auto dialer. And it's giving me 3, 6, 9, 12 different auto dialing programs. So it might be worth looking at at least look at the reviews of all of these.
Well, I will do that, Leo, but a companion question that also occurred when I was calling in, and you could tell me, is this a T-Mobile issue? Is it an Android issue? And that is, if I happen to be fortunate enough to not get a busy signal and get through to the Tech Guy program, it doesn't like an unanswered call. And I don't know how many rings, but after, let's say, 20 rings that are not answered, it disconnects.
I bet for the same reason. Now, I'll tell you why I know a little bit about this. I wrote an auto dialer in my youth. which broke all the rules. And it was called Q-Dial. I wrote it because I had a BBS. Remember BBSs where you dial in? I had the same problem that you have calling the tech guy. I only had two lines. Tech guy, at least we have six lines. And it's busy all the time. And people wanted to use my telephone, my modem-based BBS. So I wrote him a dialer for the Macintosh that would just sit there and dial. And then when it got through, it would honk at them, make play this really loud sound saying you got through. And I was told later, what you have written here is illegal. I have not done jail time, but I was told that the FCC does not want you to do that. And then now that I think about it, of course, that could be used to completely drive somebody crazy. You know, if you didn't like somebody, set an auto dialer to dial a number, it'd be a denial of service attack if you did it too fast, right? They'd never be able to use their phone. Eventually, if they were able to get through, they would be able to block your number. And gotcha. I bet you that's where the delay comes in and the limit on the number of times you can call.
But Leo, my very last question, if you'll endure this, okay? I travel for work. I go back for training 5 times a year to Florida, and I need a computer when I sit in a meeting all day for 8 hours. I have tried for the last couple of years, and it's worked reasonably well, just taking an iPad mini.
Great choice.
Keyboard.
Yeah, small.
It works fine. But my problem is I'm a Windows guy, okay? And so I'm so used to being able to do certain things on Windows, I invariably wind up having to go to the hotel business
center.
Get
a 2-in-1. In fact, this one I just talked about would be a great choice. It starts at $800, a little more expensive than an iPad, from eve-tech.com. Of course, a Microsoft Surface Pro, same thing. I think it'd be great for meetings. I think this is one of the reasons it's designed like this with a detachable keyboard. So you use it as a tablet, a little bit bigger, but it's a full Windows machine. And, of course, Windows 10 and 8 have a tablet mode, which means you don't need a keyboard. You can do everything you want, just as you would on an iPad with the tablet mode. But then it uses pogo pins to reattach. It's got a kickstand built in, which I think most iPads deserve and need. And it's just I think the Surface Pros are a great choice. I would look at those.
Okay.
And then if you're willing to take a risk with a Finnish company that has very little track record and who knows how long they'll be around, eve-tech.com. I'm pretty impressed with this one. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I wonder why Microsoft designed these, and I think it's partly because the iPad is so popular, right? You describe a very reasonable case. You're at a meeting, you're boring. You don't want to sit there with a laptop on the table. That's so obviously ignoring people. So you have it in your lap. You know, you pretend you're taking notes on it. It's a tablet, so it doesn't look like you're doing anything. You know, you're not doing spreadsheets, except you could. You could. I really like this. I would prefer to buy this over the Surface for a couple of reasons. Better battery life. Type-C charging, huge. I really dislike it that I have to buy a proprietary charger. And the fingerprint reader on the on-off switch, which is very fast and accurate. Plus, it's a beautiful screen. It looks like a 3x2. I'll have to look at the specs, but it looks like 3x2, much like the Surface. So that way, it's not a laptop, right? Same reason you use the Mini. Now, there are companies that make Windows tablets, but I think they're in many cases compromises. So I think you'd be better off going with something like this. Nishi wants to know what model Lenovo. I have two Lenovo ThinkPads that I love. The one that's here is the ThinkPad T470S. This is their business model with all the connectors, including a full-size Ethernet and HDMI. But it's not a great screen. It's a little less expensive. It's really a business workhorse. And then the one I have at home that has the OLED screen that I really is fancy is the ThinkPad X1 Yoga, second generation. Last segment of the day, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Thanks so much to Michael Cosio, our musical director. I'm doing the Irish dance now. King of the dance, Leo Flatley. Thanks also to Kim Schaffer for answering all the phones. And, of course, thanks to you for being here. Couldn't do a talk show without callers. Eric in Long Beach. Well, actually, I probably could, but that wouldn't be a good thing. Eric in Long Beach, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Eric.
How are you doing, sir?
I am well. How are you?
Good, good. So I'm about to pull the trigger on this MacBook Pro. It's a 2011. It's for my wife. She doesn't do anything but, you know, just photos and, you know, just normal stuff.
How much?
I was just wondering if that's a good... It's $600. It's refurbished.
Yeah. Oh, it's refurbished by whom?
I'm getting it through Best Buy.
So Best Buy refurbished it.
Yeah.
So generally speaking, refurb has many meanings. If you get a refurb from Apple, from the manufacturer, that has a different, considerably different meaning than Best Buy. Probably all Best Buy did is they wiped the drive, they checked a few things, made sure it's still working, and that's fine. Now, I have to tell you, I just did something similar. I happen to have a few old 2015 MacBook Pros, and Apple's still selling the 2015 model, by the way. It's the last model Apple made without a touch bar.
Okay.
And I don't like the touch bar. I also like the keyboard with a little more travel than the current Apple MacBooks, and this has that. I actually think the last great Macintosh laptop was the 2015 MacBook Pro. And I wiped the drive, installed High Sierra, works fine. Truthfully, processor jumps haven't been massive since 2012, even. So you're going to get much of the same speed. How much RAM is available in there?
It's 4 gigs.
All right. That's a little light. I'd love to see 8, but as you say, your wife isn't demanding. The nice thing is that one will support High Sierra, the current OS. That's the biggest issue.
Good.
Yeah, that's the biggest issue with older stuff is can you put the most recent Mac OS on there? And Apple offers these upgrades for free. So if they haven't, they probably have put the operating system that came with it, which I don't know, is Leopard or something.
I think you're right. Yeah, Leopard.
Yeah, you can then upgrade it to High Sierra, which I would absolutely encourage you to do.
Well, okay, I will do that. Yeah.
Do you get what kind of warranty are you getting?
You know what?
Typically, a refurb should, if it's a good refurb, should include, I would say, at least a 1-year warranty. A 3-month warranty, so you should be getting, look for a 1-year warranty. And the other thing you could look at is what you can get for a 2015. You know, how much a 2015 would cost you, because that would bring you up a little bit more recent.
I will do that.
Yeah. But I frankly, my favorite MacBook is the old 2015 MacBook Pro. It's the one I use.
All right, cool.
Yeah, so I have no problem with the 2011?
Yes.
Yeah, I have no problem with 2011.
Yeah, it's a Core i5. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's 500 gigs.
Oh, that's good. One of the things with the 2015 that I recovered is it only had 256 gig storage. It had 16 gigs RAM. That's important because you really can't upgrade the RAM on these. But it only had smaller hard drive. You can upgrade the hard drives. It's easy to upgrade the hard drives on these things. So they're expensive. I went to my favorite Otherworld Computing and bought a terabyte card. And it's an SSD, an NVMe SSD, and I bought that for $650. So it's expensive.
Oh.
But it's an easy upgrade. Yeah, it's more than the laptop. So, but 512 is fine.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Do look at, you know, just for your own benefit, Google Apple Refurb, and Apple has its own refurb store. And see,
I sure will.
And see what kind of prices. Generally, Apple's, because they're giving you the full manufacturer's warranty and all that, they're going to be a little more expensive. But I have nothing wrong with that. I think you're stuck with 4 gigs of RAM. That's not great, but it's probably adequate for just surfing. And the main thing you're going to look at when you look at an older computer is how recent can the operating system be? Will it run the current operating system well? Because we're talking massive security issues if you can't. And the good news is, I believe it can run High Sierra well, and that'll be good. That'll be good. Dale, Rancho Palos Verdes, California. Hello, Dale.
Hey, Leo. Thank you so very much for taking my call.
Well, you made it last one of the show, yeah, so thank you for holding on.
Yeah, you're very welcome. So here's the thing, and I don't know if the problem is with Coinbase or with Google Authenticator, but here's my situation. And maybe there's thousands of people like me. So I got into Bitcoin in the spring when it was about $2,700. I put a couple hundred into it, put a couple more when it went up, a couple hundred more when it kept going up, put a couple hundred more when it popped back down, boom, boom, boom. Then I went several weeks without even thinking about it. And then I forgot my password.
Oh, boy.
So I tried to go into Coinbase and clicked forgot my password, and they sent me the email. But the only way to get in is through Google Authenticator. And every single time I type in the code, it says it's an invalid code. And so now I'm going out of my mind. So then I tried to see if there was any support through Coinbase on the phone, and there is now. And when you call it, it basically says if your account's been frauded, push 1 for everybody else, just stay on the line. And then it says there are 85 trillion people trying to call us, and we can't take your call.
Oy. So let me ask you a couple of questions. I mean, Coinbase is currently, I think, the number one place people save and trade their coins.
Yeah,
And so it's and are you using an Android or iOS app for your Coinbase?
I either log in through my Mac Mac or my phone, but so, either way.
Oh, you're using a website. And yeah, when you
set up my phone.
When you set up the authenticator, they gave you a QR code and you scan it in, and it's the same phone and the same authenticator that you use to do that with.
So the way authenticators
work is they give you a secret number. You have a secret number, and the secret number is hashed with the current time of day, which means, and they change every 30 seconds to generate a 6-digit code that's unique. And it's their way of verifying that you have that phone. And so that's a very good way. And if I strongly recommend it to avoid fraud, because Bitcoin is rampant, fraud is rampant. But it's odd that your authenticator is not working. And what that concerns me is that you might have been hacked and somebody's changed the authentication process. So your password works, but not your authenticator.
Well, so I forgot the password. I tried to get a new one. So I put in a new one.
They want you to authenticate before you get the new password.
You can't get in. So I would, if I could, I'd even change it to a text message.
And they don't give you a backup method besides the authenticator.
You can, but you've got to be in to be able to reset that. I can't get in.
Hang on for just a second. We have to wrap it up, but I'm going to continue to help you off the line.
Okay, thank you.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We will be back tomorrow. We will talk more about, and I promise, less Bitcoin talk. And I'll let you know whether I got into my wallet overnight. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Have a great geek week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T, it stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.